So if you recall from last time, you know, using the time-time part of the Einstein equations, we had derived something like the Poisson equation. So just to remind you, it looks something like 1 over a squared gradient of, plus 3 times h squared psi minus h d phi dt equals minus 4 pi g rho. Okay, then after this, then we started looking at the time-space part of the Einstein tensor. So that took the form 2 over A, and then the derivative of the following combination, d phi dt minus h psi. So then this we set equal to a pi g times the time space part of the stress energy tensor, which works out to a pi g times the unperturbed density plus pressure times the velocity perturbation. And then if you recall previously, so we wrote this velocity perturbation as the gradient of some scalar perturbation. So we wrote this as a pi g rho plus p times 1 over a dv dt dx. Okay, so then setting this equal to this, okay, so you can see then that we arrive at the following expression, d phi dt minus h psi is equal to 4 pi g rho plus p times this velocity scalar perturbation. Okay, so the reason why I wrote this out is that, so in our original time-time equation, you can see that this combination of d phi dt and h psi, it appears, okay? So therefore, we can then insert the right-hand side into our original time-time equation, okay? And doing that, brings this Poisson-like equation into a form a little bit closer to what you might be used to from your old Newtonian days, okay? So if we insert this for d phi dt minus h psi, what we get is, the following, 1 over a squared times the gradient Laplacian of phi is equal to minus 4 pi g delta rho minus 3 h rho plus p times the velocity perturbation. Okay, so sometimes you'll see, this expression used as the Poisson equation, but instead I will mostly stick to this form, okay, for later on, for reasons that'll hopefully become clear later on. Okay, good. So that was the time-time, the time-space. The last one we can use is the space-space part of the Einstein equations. Okay, so those are a bit messier. In the interest of time, I'll just cut to the chase, okay? So using the space-space along with these other Einstein equations, we can derive one more independent equation relating these metric potentials to the matter perturbations, okay? So you can show that 1 over a squared Laplacian of phi plus psi is equal to 8 pi g times 1 over a squared Laplacian of this q, okay? So to remind you, this q was the scalar part of the anisotropic stress perturbation, okay? So if you recall, we had written pi ij, so the anisotropic stress perturbation, the scalar part of it we wrote as the, as the traceless part of the second derivative of q, okay? So what this says, though, is that if there is no, you know, if there is no anisotropic stress perturbation, okay, you know, so if pi ij equals zero, then we have that the metric potentials are just related by a minus sign. Okay, and so that's an important fact because, as we'll see, you know, lots of times, you know, so the anisotropic stress will be very tiny, which means that the two metric potentials will be related to each other this way. Okay, so okay, good, good. So then next, let's talk about so this anisotropic stress.
Sorry, what's capital Q again?
Yeah. Okay. Right. So if you recall, we had decomposed, so this pi ij into scalars, vectors, tensors.
Is that the scalar part?
Yeah. So this was the leftover scalar part of the anisotropic stress. Okay. You know. So I think the expression we wrote was that this is probably di dj minus 1/3 delta ij grad squared q, something like that probably. Okay, good. So the next thing then talk about is possible sources for this sort of anisotropic stress. Okay, so sources of pi ij. Okay, so to generate significant anisotropic stress, okay. The key point is that any species, the only species that can generate any significant anisotropic stress must be relativistic, okay? You know, so for the same reason, you know, that the pressure is only significant compared to the density for species that are relativistic, right? So then similarly, this form of, anisotropic pressure also clearly will be negligible for species that are non-relativistic. Does that make sense? Okay, you know, so for velocities that are small compared to the speed of light, the rest mass energy density will be much bigger than this sort of anisotropic, or pressure even. Okay, so okay, good. So therefore, the only possible then sources, for significant anisotropic stress will be species that are relativistic, i.e. radiation, which means, so possibly photons and neutrinos. Okay, so let's start with the photons first, okay? So we're gonna see that actually the photons only make a very small contribution to this anisotropic stress for most of cosmic history. And so to see this, let's start off with the Boltzmann equation for the photon perturbations. Okay, so to remind you, that took the following form. Okay, so d theta dt plus p hat over a d theta dx plus p hat over a d psi dx I plus d phi dt. Okay, and then the right hand side we derived before, the collision term was n e sigma t, and then this expression relating the difference from the monopole, and then the velocities of the electrons. Okay, right. So this was our Boltzmann equation for the photon temperature perturbations. So now what we'll do is to take moments of this. Okay. So for example, let's just average this expression. Okay, over all possible angles. Okay. So the angle average of this just gives the monopole's time derivative, right? So d theta naught dt. Okay. The angle average of this just gives the divergence of the dipole, as we saw before. Write that as divergence. Okay, the angle average of this gives, you guys, what can you tell me? Yeah, okay, so averages over all possible p hats?
Zero.
Zero, okay. The angle average of this is?
Just like 2 pi g to sort of itself.
Yeah, but I'm already dividing by 4 pi because it's the average. So yeah, so right. So it's the same thing again because the angle average of this thing is this, is itself because it's independent of angle, right? Okay, and then the right-hand side we saw last time vanishes, right? So this gives the monopole. This gives the monopole. Angle average of p hat is also vanishes because this is odd. Okay, and so okay, right. And so the average of this expression is just our continuity equation. Okay, you know, for the monopole. Okay, okay, good. So then similarly, we can take the angle average multiplying by p hat. Okay, so instead of giving us then the continuity equation, it'll give us like the Euler equation. Okay, so let's do that. Okay, so if we multiply this by p hat and then angle average, this will give the dipole's time derivative, right? Do you see that? The dipole was defined as, yeah, you know, the integral of theta perturbation multiplied by, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. The next term is a bit trickier, so I'll write it out. Okay, so it's 1 over 4 pi, also the A. Okay, p hat I, p hat j, d by dxi. That might be hard to read, sorry. D by dxi. Okay, yeah, p hat I, p hat j, of theta. Okay, so, oh yeah. And then iterated over all possible thetas, over all possible p hats. Okay, right, so the angle average of this, I can schematically think of as two pieces, one part which is isotropic, one part which is the rest. Okay, so I'll write that as theta naught plus theta minus theta naught. Okay, so I haven't done anything yet, right? The angle average of this isotropic piece will just give, again, the monopole back. Okay? So, yes, yeah, so that piece will give 1 over A, the gradient of the monopole with a 1/3. Okay, that was this piece. And then this piece, the difference from the monopole, okay? That works out to the quadrupoles, okay? I mean, right, okay. So this average over pi, pj, over all angles, it'll give the quadrupole, okay? Does everyone see that, or should I? Actually, for the interest of time, maybe I'll just assert that, yeah, this is the quadrupole. Okay, good, okay, yeah, so then this piece will then give us, 1 over A, d by dxi of theta 2 ij. Okay? Okay, good. So that was this piece. Okay? The next piece will give us, similarly, the, you know, so the derivative of the scalar potential psi. Okay? Again, with a 1/3. This piece will vanish because it's odd in p hat. Okay? And on the right-hand side, okay, this piece will vanish because it's odd in p hat. This piece will give the dipole, and this piece will give the electron velocity with a 1/3. Okay, so in total, from all of that, what we get, you know, for our Euler equation, works out to the following expression. Okay, so the time derivative of the dipole. As a vector, plus 1 over 3a, gradient of monopole plus psi, plus 1 over a, the divergence of the quadrupole, which I'll write, I don't know, is a two-headed vector, is equal to ne sigma t, electron velocity over 3 minus dipole. Okay, good. Okay, so we have our continuity equation. We have, we also have the Euler equation. One thing I want you to notice is that so the time derivative of the dipole depends on the monopole and also the quadrupole. Okay, we could similarly do this again. Okay, put in another p hat to get a time derivative for the quadrupole. It'll depend on the dipole and the octopole, okay? We could put in another p hat to get the time derivative of the octopole. It'll depend on the quadrupole and the next one, I think it's called the hexadecapole, okay? Right, okay, so you can see that we have this infinite hierarchy, okay? It's the exact same as that previous BBG, the BBGKY hierarchy that we saw before, okay? The difference, though, here is, you know, is that for the photons, this hierarchy will not be infinite. So instead, the hierarchy is going to truncate, and it'll do so because of the right-hand side, the collision piece. Okay. So to see that, actually, okay, good. So then let's actually schematically try and do now the next moment. Okay. You know, and it's the average putting in two p hats. Okay. Right. So as I said, okay. So the left-hand side will have something that looks like the time derivative of the quadrupole. Okay, we'll also have a piece that looks like the gradient of the dipole. We'll have a piece that looks like the divergence of the octopole. Okay, right. The right-hand side, though, okay, the only surviving piece will be this one, which gives us Ne sigma t times the quadrupole with a minus sign. Okay, so you can see that the right-hand side of our equation, okay, for the time derivative of the quadrupole, the right-hand side is proportional to the quadrupole with a minus sign. Okay, so therefore this term exponentially kills the quadrupole, okay, at a rate set by this rate, which is the Compton scattering rate. Okay, now competing with that will be these source terms on the left-hand side, okay, so these derivatives of the dipole and the octopole, okay. So when this, you know, this damping term is large compared to these terms, okay, the quadrupole gets exponentially tiny, right? Or it gets damped exponentially quickly, right? Okay, so the question is, okay, you know, so then when is this term large or small compared to these terms, okay? So intuitively, or, you know, schematically, the way to think about this is that, okay, so there's, you know, so these derivatives of dipole and octopole, you know, schematically, we can think of them as something like, you know, the dipole divided by some length scale, okay, you know, some sort of like coherence scale. Similarly, this octopole term is something like the octopole divided by, again, some sort of length scale. This term looks like the quadrupole divided by the mean free path. Oh, that's terrible. Do you guys see that? Okay. Okay, so this is the number density, the cross section. So therefore, this is 1 over the mean free path. Okay? So therefore, on scales that are small compared to the mean free path, these terms can be significant, okay? And in contrast, on scales that are large compared to the photon mean free path, these terms will be small, driving the quadrupole to be really tiny, okay? Right, okay, so, you know, so in practice you can see that, you know, the size of the quadrupole will be something like the dipole multiplied by this ratio of scales, okay, the mean free path compared to this, you know, length scale. Or if we think instead in, you know, like, you know, in Fourier space in terms of wave numbers, this says that, you know, the quadrupole is of order the dipole multiplied by k times the mean free path. Okay? Now, the point here is that before recombination, the mean free path is really, really tiny, okay? Compton scattering is happening at a tremendous rate, okay? And so since the mean free path is tiny, okay, then, you know, then therefore the quadrupole gets driven also to a tiny value, okay? And then the same statement then holds true for all the higher multipoles as well, right? So similarly, the octopole will be small compared to the quadrupole by this same ratio, okay, k times the mean free path, and so on and so on, okay? Now, following recombination, the photon mean free path gets very large, okay? And so therefore, following recombination, the quadrupole, octopole, et cetera, can become significant, okay? But before recombination, they're all really tiny. Okay, so does that make sense? Okay, so now why am I talking at all about the quadrupole? Okay, so before, just now, we were talking about the photon contribution to this pi ij, right? You know, right? You know, we're talking about the photon contribution to this anisotropic stress. Okay, right. Now the reason why I'm talking about the quadrupole in relation to this anisotropic stress is that pi ij just literally corresponds to the quadrupole of the angular distribution of the photons. Okay, so one way to see this, you know, is to write this in Fourier space. Okay, so in Fourier space, this looks like, also I guess this is 1 over a squared. So yeah, so it'll be something like k squared over a squared times k hat I, k hat j, minus 1/3 delta ij, k times q. And this is just a quadrupole, right? This is just the spin 2 part of that distribution. Okay, so therefore we can see that the so this anisotropic stress, okay, you know, so you know, so this pi ij literally does just correspond to the quadrupole of the angular distribution. And so the fact that Compton scattering sets the quadrupole to be tiny for the photons before recombination means that also pi ij is also tiny for the photons before recombination. Okay, now following, so following recombination, the mean free path gets very large. And so in principle, the photon contribution to pi ij can become significant, okay? But recall though that recombination happens after matter radiation equality, okay? So by that time, the photon contribution to the total stress energy of the universe becomes subdominant, okay? And so for that reason, you know, from now on, I'll be neglecting the photon contribution to the anisotropic stress. Okay, good. So then that leaves the neutrinos. Okay. So any questions about any of that?
The recombination energy scale is the same energy scale as that when photons escape.
Recombination was when the electrons and the charged ions combined to form neutral atoms. Okay. So at that time, Compton scattering off of charged particles becomes much rarer, and so the mean free path becomes very large, right? You know, right? So I mean, right? You know, so this time of recombination, you know, that time, you know, I mean, that time corresponds to the last scattering time for the photons, right? And right, and so since they're not scattering anymore, then they're just freely streaming. They have stopped diffusing, right? And that, yeah. Okay. So yeah, so does that make sense? Yeah. Other questions? Okay, if not, then let's then talk about neutrinos. Okay, so same argument we're going to use for the neutrinos. Okay, so before where was I? Yeah, so before weak freeze out, right? The neutrinos were, you know, scattering very frequently. You know, with all of the standard model particles, okay? So then similarly for neutrinos, pi ij is also negligible before weak freeze out, okay? which again was temperatures, you know, like temperatures of order like MeV or so, right? Following weak freeze-out, neutrinos can freely stream, and therefore they do produce a non-trivial amount of this anisotropic stress. So for temperatures less than twiddle MeV, okay, there can be a significant anisotropic stress from neutrinos. Okay, and so therefore, during those times, we'll have psi not equal to minus phi. Okay, so in practice, during these times, you can show numerically this works out to something like phi is about equal to minus psi times 1 plus 2 fifths, the omega at that time in neutrinos. Okay, but again, though, following recombination, so after matter radiation equality, the neutrino contribution to the total stress energy becomes subdominant. Okay, and so for energies less than 0.1 electron volts or so, again, okay, pi ij becomes basically negligible for our purposes. Okay, right, so not at the percent level, but for our purposes in this class, it will be negligible. Okay. And so therefore, again, for the purposes of computing CMB perturbations, we will neglect both neutrino and also photon anisotropic stress. Okay. So any questions about any of that? Let me go on. Okay. So the key point from all of that just was, during the times of during the eras of interest to us, okay, it will be the case that that these two metric potentials will be related to each other just by a minus sign, okay. Okay, good. So right, okay. So last time we had written down all of the evolution equations for all the perturbations, right? The one missing thing was the evolution equations for the metric potentials, and now we have those as well. Okay, so therefore now we have everything, right? So now we have a complete set of these evolution equations for all the perturbations. To remind you, these are coupled linear partial differential equations. Okay, and so in principle, we could solve these coupled linear PDEs numerically. And next week in your tutorial, you guys will get some practice solving these, these coupled equations numerically. But before doing that, there are a few details I want to discuss, some small things that will make this solution a bit more convenient for you guys, okay? So first, one simple thing we can do to make these equations easier to solve is the following. Okay, so to remind you, so our perturbation variables have included scalar quantities like the, things like the dark matter density, the baryon density, the photon monopole, and so on. And also we've had these vector-like perturbations like the dark matter bulk velocity, the baryon bulk velocity, the photon dipole, and so on. Right. Now, as I said, we're only keeping the scalar part of these vector-like perturbations, right? And so therefore, for convenience, it'll be simpler to write these vector-like quantities in terms of scalar quantities, okay? And so what I'll do is to, to replace this V with some scalar that I'll write as capital V, okay? So we'll write that this velocity vector is the derivative of some scalar quantity, call it capital V. Similarly for the baryons, so little v will be some derivative of some capital V. And then similarly for the photon dipole. Okay, so I'll just make up some notation. So I'll write the dipole vector as 1 over A, the derivative, and I'll call it as omega. Okay. Again, some scalar quantity. Okay, so in terms of these new scalar variables, okay, so it's easy to rewrite our previous perturbation equations. Okay, so for example, the dark matter continuity equation just becomes d delta dt plus 1 over a squared the Laplacian of capital V plus 3 d phi dt equals 0. Okay, and then similarly for the other equations as well. Okay, all I've done just is to replace these vector-looking quantities with the underlying scalar degrees of freedom. Okay.
We disregard the curl parts for this.
That's right. So all this time we've been throwing away the curl parts, which were the vector degrees of freedom of these quantities. Right. And the reason, which we haven't gotten to, you know, is that those vector-like degrees of freedom are not generated during inflation. But hopefully we'll get to something like that next week. Okay, right. Okay, right. Okay, so, okay, good. So that was one thing that'll make this a little bit more convenient. The next little trick you can do to make this more convenient is the following. Okay, so as I said, these are partial differential equations, right? So they have both time derivatives and also space derivatives at the same time. Okay, and in general, solving PDEs numerically is a hard problem. Okay. Luckily though, So maybe I should just explain why it's a hard problem, right? Okay, so if you want to solve for the time evolution of, say, delta dark matter at this location, okay, you know, the solution here depends on the solution at the neighboring points due to the spatial derivatives, right? But their solution depends on their neighbors, and so on and so on, okay? And so therefore, solving for everything all at once is a really messy, complicated problem, okay? But luckily for us, though, we have linear partial differential equations. And so because they're linear, we can make this problem much easier by Fourier transforming, okay? So for example, okay, let's consider, so our continuity equation for the dark matter perturbation. In Fourier space, this just becomes d delta dt minus k squared over a squared v plus 3 d phi dt equals 0, okay? And then similarly for the other equations as well, okay? So by Fourier transforming, we've turned all these spatial derivatives just into powers of k, okay? So why does that help? Well, it helps because now we've converted these PDEs into ODEs, right? And of course, ODEs are, of course, you know, much easier to solve than PDEs. The other important reason is that because these are linear differential equations, that makes each of these evolution equations independent for different wave numbers k, okay? So if you write out all of the equations for perturbations at some k, they'll depend on the other variables at that k. They'll depend upon the value of k, but they will not depend on the solution at some other value of k. Okay? Good. And that's true because, again, these are linear equations. Had the equations been nonlinear, okay, Fourier transforming then would have coupled the solution at some k to some, to some other k's as well. Okay, but because these are linear equations, the solutions at each k become independent. They decouple from all the other wave numbers. So therefore, we can get a complete solution for all possible wave numbers just by, solving these equations one by one separately for each wave number. Okay, and that's a much simpler calculation than trying to do this in real configuration space, where we have to solve simultaneously for all positions at the same time. Okay, right, okay, yes, okay, right. So therefore Fourier transforming makes all the k's independent. Right, okay, good. So then in your tutorial, this is the approach that you guys are going to follow. Okay, so what you'll do is to solve for the the evolution of all the perturbations at a few different k's as a function of time, and then you'll observe the behavior in these various different regimes. Okay, so good. So now with all, okay, good. So then with that being said, let me just write out the equations that you guys will be solving. Just one time, just to have them all in one place. Okay, good. So first we had the Poisson equation that I just erased for some reason. Okay, so, right. So our Poisson equation took the form 1 over a squared gradient squared of phi plus 3 h squared psi minus h d phi dt is equal to minus 4 pi g delta rho. Okay, and now again, I'm going to assume that psi is equal to minus phi. Okay, and the right-hand side, this delta rho, this corresponds to the total density perturbation, which is sum of all of the different species. Okay, so this delta rho, again, is, yeah, delta rho dark matter plus the, you know, delta rho baryon plus delta rho photon, etc. Okay, so I'll write that as rho dark matter delta dark matter plus rho baryon delta baryon plus rho photon theta. Okay, why is there a 4 here compared to the other ones?
Omega is 3 for radiation.
Sorry? Omega is 3 for radiation. Omega is 3 for radiation. Sorry, I don't understand. I'm just asking, right, so for the total density perturbation, okay, why is the photon contribution to the total density perturbation, the mean density of photons times the temperature perturbation times 4, right? You know, these were just the mean density times the density perturbation times 1. Okay, so why is there a 4? Okay, what was theta naught again?
It was defined with respect to the distribution function. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, but right. Okay, but what was theta defined as? Okay, so this delta was delta rho over rho, and theta was what?
Didn't we introduce it with the temperature?
Yes, it was the temperature fluctuation. It was the delta T over T.
Yes.
Okay, so how is delta T over T compared? I mean, right, so how is the temperature related to density?
For radiation, is T
to the
fourth. It's T to the fourth, so therefore the delta rho over rho for radiation will be 4 delta T over T. Yeah. Okay, right. And then similarly for neutrinos and so on. Okay, to make this more convenient, I will write this in terms of the omegas. Okay, so then our right-hand side is going to become minus 3 halves H squared omega dark matter delta dark matter plus omega baryon delta baryon plus 4 omega photon, theta zero, and so on. Okay, and just note that these omegas are the omegas at that time, not the present day omegas. Okay, so if we rearrange this equation to get the d phi dt on the left-hand side, okay, and then Fourier transform to turn this gradient squared into a k squared, what we get is the following expression. D phi dt is equal to h multiplied by the following 1 half omega dark matter delta dark matter plus omega baryon delta baryon plus 4 omega photon theta naught. Okay, and then minus then the other terms, so 1 plus 1 third k over ah squared. multiplied by phi. Okay, so good. So that's our first equation. And then let me just rewrite then the other equations that you'll be solving. Okay, so right, so then next we have the fluid equations. Okay, so we have the continuity equation for the dark matter, d delta dt is equal to k over a squared times this velocity scalar minus 3 phi dt. And the Euler equation for dark matter becomes really simple. It's dv dt. Okay, the baryon equations will be a similar form. So we have the continuity equation, d delta dt for the baryons is k over a squared v baryon minus 3 d phi dt, just like the dark matter. Okay, but the Euler equation has this extra term from the photon collisions. Is the same phi plus 4 rho gamma over 3 rho baryon ne sigma t 3 omega 1 minus v baryon. Okay, and then lastly, then we'll have the photon equations, which take the following form. The time derivative of the monopole is k over a squared, and then with this dipole scalar, minus d phi dt. And then lastly, then the equation, the Euler equation for the photons becomes d omega dt is h omega 1. Okay, and then the Compton scattering term. V over 3 minus omega. Okay, so that's all the evolution equations. You'll also need the Hubble expansion rate as a function of time. And so to remind you, that was H of A is H naught, omega radiation a to the minus 4 plus omega dark matter plus omega baryon a to the minus 3 plus omega lambda, and so on and so on. Okay, yeah, so I'll, yeah, good. So all that to the 1/2. Okay, and then similarly, then there are simple expressions for the present day omegas in terms of these. The time-dependent omegas in terms of the present-day omegas. Okay, so the point though is that we have seven variables and seven independent first-order ordinary differential equations. Okay, so good. So yeah, so the next week then you'll be solving these numerically. But there's one more point to make before doing that. Okay. So if you take these equations and just plug them into your ODE solver, okay, what you'll find is that at very early times, your solver just dies, okay? You know, so what'll happen is that, so if you try and solve these equations as is at high redshift, so your ODE solver will try and, you know, I mean, like us will try and take like infinitely many super, super tiny time steps, okay? The reason for that is that your ODE solver will try and, so your solver will try to resolve the Compton scattering time scale, okay? So, yeah, so what'll happen is that it'll try and set the time step, delta t, to less than 1 over n e sigma t, okay? Right, because, well, right, so you can see that in the Euler equations for the photons and also for the baryons, we have this enormous Ne sigma t appearing on, appearing on the right-hand side, okay? So the fact that these are enormous, right, so that fact keeps the photons tightly coupled to the baryons physically, okay? But numerically, when you try and solve these equations, okay, the solver will try to resolve that time scale, okay? And so doing so will set this time step to be like infinitely tiny, therefore taking like infinitely many time steps, okay? And so to get around that problem, most of these codes use an approximation to fix this, which is called the tight coupling approximation. Okay, so let me just motivate that for you, okay? So, right, so this approximation just basically involves treating the baryons and the photons as a single fluid in the same way that we're treating the electrons and the ions as a single tightly coupled fluid, okay? So to see how this works, let's take our Euler equation for the baryons here, okay? So in this term, since this Ne sigma t is large, it means that this quantity in the parentheses in total has to be small, right? Okay, so therefore we have to have that this VB is approximately equal to 3 omega 1, right? At least during times when, times before recombination when the electron density is large. Okay, so good. So then let's use that fact to make an approximation, okay? So first, let's invert this expression, okay, to write VB in terms of the other quantities. Okay, so doing so, what we get is that this VB is equal to 3 omega 1 minus 3 rho baryon over 4 rho photon times 1 over Ne sigma t. Times dV baryon dt minus phi. Okay, so far I haven't made any approximations. However, though, now notice that this huge number is now in the denominator instead of the numerator. Okay, so therefore now this term now is small. Okay, also notice that this same VB also appears in the right hand side of this expression, okay? So since we know that that VB is close to 3 omega 1, okay, then to a first approximation, we can replace this VB just with 3 omega 1, okay, to a first approximation, okay? The correction to that approximation will be of order 1 over Ne sigma t squared, right? Do you all see that? Okay, so then doing that, let's just replace this with 3 omega 1. And also to make the notation simpler, let me write this quantity, this whole ratio, as capital R. Okay, so I'll define this ratio as 3 rho baryon over 4 rho photon. Okay, so good. So then this thing just becomes R. Okay, good. So far, so good. So now let's notice that this VB, it also appears in the photon Euler equation, right? So then let's replace that VB with this expression, okay? And so doing so, we'll get the following expression. Okay, so we'll get d omega 1 dt equals h omega 1 plus pi minus monopole divided by 3 minus r d omega 1 dt minus pi over 3. Okay, Now we have d omega dt on both sides. Okay, so good. So, so I'll just move this term over to the left-hand side. Okay, so we get 1 plus r d omega 1 dt, and then the rest is the same. One third, 1 plus r phi minus monopole. Okay, then I'll just divide both sides by this 1 plus r. Okay, so I get over 1 plus r over 1 plus r. We can even, you know, next insert this expression, back into our expression for VB here. Okay, and so doing so, we get our final expression that we'll use, which is that this VB is approximately 3 omega 1 minus r over 1 plus r 1 over ne sigma t 3 omega 1 minus theta. Okay, good. So this is the tight coupling approximation. Okay, the reason for doing this is that once we make this approximation, no longer will there be any factors of this ne sigma t in the numerator. Okay, so instead they'll all appear instead as 1 over ne sigma t, making this problem much more numerically tractable. Okay, good. So then what you'll do is to make this tight coupling approximation before recombination, and then after recombination, then you'll go back to the original expressions. Okay. So does that make sense what we're doing here, right? So before recombination, any sigma t is large, so therefore numerically makes sense to put it in the denominator. After recombination, any sigma t is small, so therefore then it makes sense to keep it, in the numerator as opposed to the denominator. Okay, good. Right. Let's see, any other little tips? One other thing that makes this a bit easier to do is to try and make everything dimensionless, okay? So already the overdensities, delta, is dimensionless, the monopole is dimensionless, et cetera, right? But we still have some dimensionful quantities, okay? So for example, we have time has dimensions, these various velocity potentials, they have dimensions. And so one thing to do to make this even easier is to make everything dimensionless. That can be done the following way, pretty easily.
Okay. Can I ask something?
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Since we said that this approximation is for before
recombination,
when it's in the denominator. Mm-hmm. Do we need to put the recombination when recombination happens by hand?
Yes.
For the equations?
That's right.
Do we need to impose it? Then?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Right. But luckily, I think in your previous tutorial, you guys worked out when recombination happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you'll do is to approximate that process as being instantaneous. Okay. So you'll evolve using this approximation all the way down to the mean redshift of recombination. Okay, and then that time just suddenly switch over to the other expression, right?
Okay. But will everything still evolve continuously even if we do it sort of?
Yes, you have to match the time derivatives at that time. Yeah. Right. Okay. Good. So then last thing, let me just briefly explain how to make all this dimensionless. Okay, so the first easy thing you can do is to change your time coordinate. Okay, so instead of using t as your time coordinate, you can use a, or say you can use the scale factor a, or instead you can use log a as your time coordinate. Okay, so for example, the d by dt is just equal to h d by d log a. Okay. So doing so will then turn all of these into h times d by d log a, okay, which will then cancel these other h's. And then also then, to make things dimensionless, it helps to switch from these, you know, these velocity scalars as your code parameters instead to the product of h times these velocity scalars. Okay, so for v, for v baryon, and also for the photon potential. Okay, so this product is dimensionless. Also, if you do both of these, okay, one nice thing that'll happen is that the wave number k, okay, you know, appearing here, and so on, okay, you know, if you do both of these substitutions, k will only ever appear in the combination of k over ah. Okay, and so doing so, you know, helps to elucidate, you know, some important behavior that you'll find numerically, which might otherwise be unintuitive, okay? You know, so what you'll find is that the evolution has two different regimes, okay? So you'll see different behavior when k is much, much smaller than ah versus k much, much larger than ah, okay? And so if you make the equations dimensionless, when k only appears, if k only appears in this combination, then it makes sense why this AH matters for K. Okay, you know, but otherwise might be sort of unintuitive, why this scale matters for the wave number. As we'll see, the horizon scale generically is of order 1 over H, okay? And so wave numbers with K much, much less than AH we call super horizon or outside the horizon. These modes are subhorizon, and so what you'll find is that the way that these perturbations behave, the time evolution changes once the modes go from superhorizon to subhorizon, okay, right? Because again, AH changes over time, okay. Hubble is decreasing over time, AH is decreasing over time, and so early on, modes start out outside the horizon. Then they enter the horizon later on, okay? And so what you'll find numerically is that, these perturbations, right, so they will grow in a certain way while they're outside the horizon, then their behavior will change once they are inside the horizon, okay? Okay, good, so good. So then next week then you will see how these solutions look. Now just to be clear, right, so I have dropped like some things just for simplicity, okay, right, so here I'm ignoring neutrinos, okay? But in detail, neutrinos should be included, but for the purposes of this class, we can ignore them. I've been really sneaky, okay? So in our Euler equation for the photons, I've dropped the quadrupole piece, okay? In principle, after recombination, that should be included, okay? So here, I've neglected it, which means that the photon perturbations after recombination will not be evolved correctly. Okay, luckily though for us, for the matter perturbations, that won't matter because after recombination, again, the photons are very subdominant, okay? So therefore the solutions you'll get for the dark matter and baryon perturbations, they'll be pretty close to, the full professional codes, as you guys will see. Okay, good. So now we have everything in place to solve these coupled differential equations. The last thing we're missing is the initial conditions, okay? So then next time on Monday, we'll talk about the process setting these initial conditions, which is called inflation, okay? And so we'll stop here for now. On Monday, we'll start talking about inflation very, very quickly. Okay, so yeah, we'll stop here, thanks.